From WDAV in Davidson, North Carolina, this is The Recovery Room, making sense of modern medicine. I'm Dr. Rick Green.
The fact that we're still writing all the notes by hand and faxing things and printing them out and mailing them, I mean, this is not a tenable way to, I think, practice medicine in the 21st century.
Next year, the federal government will start distributing some $27 billion to U.S. hospitals to promote electronic health record usage. The problem? 98% of hospitals aren't technologically up to speed enough to qualify for the money.
It's a deeply layered issue that can't be easily reduced to sound bites, and that's the way our public policymakers have largely been treating this issue for the last few years. So it's time to modulate our debate around these issues and start paying attention to the evidence.
The author of a recent study that attempts to measure the real cost of medical liability and defensive medicine. Coming up on The Recovery Room.
The Recovery Room is made possible in part by a grant from the Society of American Gastrointestinal and Endoscopic Surgeons Educational and Research Foundation.
Making sense of modern medicine. This is The Recovery Room. I'm Dr. Rick Green. Medicine is no stranger to the technological cutting edge. In many respects, it's been a great innovator and adopter of new technologies. But when it comes to record keeping, the medical industry is still in the dark ages. While other industries have long gone digital, the bulk of record keeping in U.S. hospitals is still being done on paper. Harvard researcher Ashish Jha has published a troubling progress report about electronic health record adoption rates. On today's show, we talk with Dr. Jha about what's taking medicine so long to go digital and what the delay means for patient safety. And later in the show, Jha's colleague at the Harvard School of Public Health, Michelle Mello, puts a dollar figure on a politically divisive area of medicine, medical liability and defensive medicine spending. Is there any aspect of our lives that hasn't gone digital? Many of us carry around weeks' worth of entertainment on portable devices that fit in a purse or a pocket. We communicate almost exclusively by email, text, and cell phone. Even our most private transactions are done online, shopping, banking, stock trading. So what's the big deal with electronic health records? Is the healthcare industry really so far behind the rest of the world in making the digital transition? According to a recently published progress report, the answer is a definitive yes. According to the report, only 12% of U.S. hospitals had adopted basic electronic health records by the end of 2009. Next year, the federal government will start awarding $27 billion in incentives that promote electronic health record, or EHR, adoption and usage. But that $27 billion will only be distributed to hospitals that meet meaningful use requirements. That is, electronic health record usage that achieves significant improvements in care. According to that same progress report, less than 2%, yes, 2%, of U.S. hospitals currently meet these standards. Joining us now is the co-author of that recent progress report, Dr. Ashish Jha. Dr. Jha is an associate professor of health policy and management at the Harvard School of Public Health. He is also a practicing general internist and a senior advisor to the Undersecretary of Health at the Veterans Administration. Dr. Jha, thanks so much for joining us in the Recovery Room.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick. I'm excited to be here.
Let me ask you to start off with, you know, despite the dreary rate of electronic health record adoption so far, it's probably fair to say that we will experience something close to 100% adoption in the not-too-distant future. But what is the holdup here? I mean, is it fair to compare the healthcare industry to other industries that did their digital upgrades 5 or 10 years ago?
I think it is fair to make that comparison, and I agree with you that at some point down the road, we will make the transition and we will have a healthcare system that is fully digital. The question, of course, is when, how expensive is it going to be, how disruptive is it going to be, and what are the benefits that are going to eventually come to us when we get there?
Well, I mean, beyond the obvious advantages of having digital copies of patient records as opposed to paper records, what's the big picture argument for electronic health records? How will full compliance make patient care better?
There are a couple of obvious advantages. Anybody who's ever tried to read a physician's handwriting, I think, will immediately understand that when the legibility goes up, things like errors can really be decreased. One of the things I find as a practicing physician when I've practiced in the systems that have paper-based records is a lot of critical information I need to make good decisions is not available when I need it. And I'm often finding myself flying, you know, without the information that I needed to make good decisions. And that's something that electronic records really changes. It allows me to look at all of the data about a patient's past history. Allows me to know what kind of allergies they might have, what other medications they're on. And so it lets me make much better decisions. And so good electronic health record systems that have what we call good clinical decision support tools. It'll tell you if you're about to order a prescription for a medicine, let's say that the patient has an allergy to, or there's an interaction with another drug. Those kinds of things can be very helpful in preventing errors and just letting doctors practice better care.
So again, we can assume that incorrect data will be kept from getting into the patient record?
Well, that I'm not sure we can make that assumption. I mean, I think the problem is that incorrect data has gotten into the record when you have paper-based records, and surely people can make mistakes and enter in the wrong information electronically. The good news about electronic records is that it lets you track who's entered information in, who's looked at the information, and good electronic record systems let you identify erroneous information and get rid of it in a way that's harder in the paper-based world.
Let me get to some of the specifics of your report, which is really quite fascinating. By the end of last year, you stated about 12% of U.S. hospitals had adopted at least basic electronic health records, but only 2% of hospitals have actually met the government's meaningful use requirements. Could you define meaningful use requirements for us?
Sure. So, you know, I think as you alluded to in the beginning of this report, meaningful use is the definition that the government is using to give out financial incentives. And the motivation here is that the government didn't want to just give incentives for people to buy electronic record systems and install them but not use them effectively. And so there are a bunch of criteria that doctors and hospitals have to meet to get the meaningful use incentives. And they primarily look at things like, hey, are you prescribing electronically? Are you capturing key pieces of patient data electronically? Are you keeping that information secure? Are you able to generate quality scores on your patients and submit that electronically to regulatory bodies that oversee that work? Some really basic stuff that providers have to be able to do in order to ensure that they're providing good care. Meaningful use requires all of those things. And as you suggested, we found that by end of 2009, only 2% of American hospitals can meet those requirements.
We're talking with Dr. Ashish Jha. Dr. Jha is an associate professor of health policy and management at the Harvard School of Public Health. Ashish, once a hospital has invested in the electronic record keeping, how long do you think it will take for them to really meet the concepts of meaningful use? What's the time frame we're talking about?
Well, it's going to vary a little bit based on the size of the hospital, but I think for the average, let's say, you know, small or medium-sized hospital, it's probably still anywhere between a six-month and a two-year process. And I say that because putting these systems in is not trivial work. And it's highly disruptive. It really changes how physicians and nurses work within that hospital. And to be able to do all the things that meaningful use requires is not something you can just turn on overnight. It's a process. I've seen some larger hospitals, for instance, that have rolled it out over 3, 4, 5 years. Now, that's going to be tough because the incentives are set up to be given out over a much shorter time period than that. And so hospitals might try to move it up and do it a little more quickly. But you can't rush it. At the end of the day, it's going to take a time for most hospitals to be able to install electronic records.
I think the magic year is 2015. Is that correct?
Exactly. After that, there are actually penalties if you haven't done it.
Well, you know, this the concern that we might have is that this increases the divide between the haves and the have-nots. I mean, small rural hospitals go out of business because they can't compete. Are we going to see this effect because of the likelihood that they have to have this in place?
Yeah, It's a very legitimate concern, and even our own data, the data from the report that you mentioned, as well as other work that we've done in the past, shows that exactly those hospitals, the small hospitals, the rural hospitals, and then even a lot of the safety net hospitals in big cities, they're further behind. They're starting off further behind. In the small amount of time that we've been able to track this, we were seeing that they're not moving as quickly as the bigger hospitals. And I actually think that these small rural hospitals need it more than the big academic centers do. And so the government is aware of these data, and you know, we've certainly shared our findings with a lot of the policymakers. And there are efforts to try to make sure that the small rural hospitals don't fall behind. The question is, are those efforts going to be enough? And I have some concerns about, you know, whether we're really going to start seeing this new digital divide between the haves and the have-nots.
Well, of course, now most hospitals can't create their own EHR. Some big centers do, but we have to depend on the technology. How good is the technology? The software manufacturers, are they compatible with each other?
So, to answer the second part of your question first, you know, are they compatible with each other? Unfortunately, most of them are not, and it's actually even worse than it sounds. You know, until very recently, if you bought one electronic health record system, Rick, and I went to that same company 6 months later and bought an electronic record system, our two systems may not be able to talk to each other because they might be slightly different versions. Now, the government, in its efforts to try to create some standards, has been working hard on setting some basic rules that all EHR, electronic health record vendors, have to follow. But I am not optimistic that somehow is going to magically make these systems interoperable. What I worry a lot about is, are we going to just create new silos where everybody has their electronic record system, but nobody's able to talk to each other?
Well, as you said, you're a believer, of course, and you're adopting this very well in your own practice. What do you say to the physicians in a hospital who potentially aren't on the same page as you are?
Right.
They're going to hold their own hospital back. How do we handle the individual physician?
Yeah. You know, I guess what I tell them is, I think there is a little bit of a reality check that I think you have to do in the year 2010. As you started off with this show, I mean, you know, we do almost everything electronically now. And the benefits are really pretty obvious. And the notion that somehow in the year 2010, you know, the healthcare system, which is almost one-fifth of our economy, the fact that we're still writing all the notes by hand and faxing things and printing them out and mailing them, I mean, this is not a tenable way to I think, practice medicine in the 21st century. And so when I have colleagues who push back, who have concerns, I try to understand specifically what's bothering them about the electronic record. The electronic records, most of them are hardly perfect. They have real challenges. And I think the key to success is to figure out how to address the specific concerns that doctors have. But I don't think this broad notion that we ought to stay in a paper-based world, which we know contribute to tens of thousands of deaths every year and lots of errors, I don't think that notion is tenable. I think we have to make the switch, but we have to be thoughtful about it.
Let me turn to patient privacy for a minute. What are your concerns about patient privacy and the electronic healthcare record? Are there valid concerns that people will lose their personal information?
I think privacy is such an incredibly important issue that it's always valid to be concerned, and it's always good to be vigilant about this. I have two kind of big picture thoughts on this. One is that paper-based records are very insecure. I mean, the truth is that any hospital employee can go open up a chart and look at any patient's information almost without impunity, and nobody could track that. And at least in an electronic record system, you can track who's looked at the information, why did they look at it, and have a paper trail, as it were, sort of a record that allows actually, I think, more security than paper-based records do. Now, the problem with electronic records, of course, is that we worry about things like hacking. We worry about, will somebody from the outside steal records? You know, I the government's been very concerned about this, and I have seen some real efforts to try to make sure that we're using the best security protocols. And then, of course, we know that other industries have been able to do this. You know, the banking industry does this. The last time I went to see a, a teller was, you know, probably many years ago. I do all my banking online. I'm sure a lot of your listeners do. And yet they're able to keep much of that stuff very secure. My general confidence is that the healthcare industry will be able to do a pretty good job. But the truth is there will be lapses because none of this stuff is perfect. And vigilance is the only way we're going to make sure that those lapses are infrequent and not detrimental to patients.
You know, it's been debated frequently, who really controls the record? Should the hospital, the physician, the patient? How will the electronic record give patients more control over their information? And what are the possible consequences of this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a couple of thoughts on it. One is that if you look at the stimulus bill that you know, gives the financial incentives for doctors and hospitals to adopt electronic records, one of the central tenets in it is that patients have to have access to that electronic record. They should be able to get copies of it. They should be able to get electronic copies of it, and it's got to be done in a timely fashion. So I think in that way specifically, the electronic record system moves us forward towards being more patient-centric and giving patients better access to their own data. That said, I think we still haven't solved the problem of who really owns these data. Right now, the truth is that doctors and hospitals own the data and in the paper-based world. And when we switch to electronic records, that's a conversation we need to have about how much access should patients get. My own personal opinion is that patients should get complete access to their own data and that there should be very strict rules about who that data is shared with. Obviously, it needs to go to insurance companies for payment reasons, and that part's fine. But using it for any other purpose, I really think if you're not using it for clinical care, you're not using it for payment, you really need to have the patient's involvement.
Ashish, thanks so much for being on the Recovery Room.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Ashish Jha is an associate professor of health policy and management at the Harvard School of Public Health. He is also a practicing general internist and a senior advisor to the Undersecretary for Health at the Veterans Administration. Dr. Jha's progress report about electronic health record adoption rates was published in a recent issue of Health Affairs. Making Sense of Modern Medicine. This is the Recovery Room. I'm Dr. Rick Green. We're online at recoveryroomshow.org. The political battle over health reform was fought on many fronts. Among them, the country's costly medical liability system. Estimates about the cost of medical liability, specifically the cost of doctors practicing defensive medicine, have varied widely. Some have placed the cost in the hundreds of billions of dollars, approaching 20% or more of total healthcare spending. A recent report published in Health Affairs puts the cost of medical liability closer to 2.5%. But even that figure would amount to an estimated $55 billion spent every year on medical liability, $46 billion of which is being spent on defensive medicine, unnecessary tests and procedures prescribed by doctors in an effort to avoid lawsuits. Democrats and Republicans disagree about the best way to curb defensive medicine spending, with most Republicans, and physicians, favoring tort reform like caps on damages. Dr. Michelle Mello is the lead author of the recent study that appeared in Health Affairs. She's a professor of law and public health at the Harvard School of Public Health. She's described the medical malpractice system as deeply flawed, but has also questioned the emphasis on tort reform as the best solution to the problem. Michelle Mello, thanks so much for joining us today on the Recovery Room.
Thanks for having me.
Michelle, let me start off by asking you your figure for the total annual cost of the medical liability system, which includes defensive medicine spending, is about $55.5 billion, or about 2.4% of total health care spending. Now, it's lower than some other estimates that have been thrown around. Now, one extreme example is that of Tom Price, who's a Republican congressman from Georgia, who actually put the figure at $650 billion and 25% of health care spending. You've talked about wanting to create a more defensible estimate of medical malpractice costs. Now, if yours becomes a more or less accepted figure, what kind of policy decisions would you hope to see that are based on your research?
Well, I think it really informs the debate by helping us frame our expectations around medical liability reform. There are many good reasons to be pursuing liability reform, particularly reforms that kind of break the mold, get away from the traditional approaches that we know are not very impressive in terms of their performance, and move us into more innovative territory that addresses not just liability costs, but also patient safety improvement. But we should have realistic expectations about what this is going to buy us in terms of savings on our overall national health care bill. Our analysis shows that we spend lavishly on medical liability costs every year, but in comparison to the obscene amounts we spend taking care of our fellow Americans through our health care system, it's really just a drop in the bucket.
Now, you've called the malpractice system flawed or deeply flawed. Many patients never get compensated for medical error. Many others sue who aren't really victims of negligence. Are there any solutions out there that offer any promise for changing the status quo of the entire system?
I certainly think so. And again, I'd focus attention on things that have not really been tried here in the U.S., but in some cases have been tried in other settings. I think we've been relatively disappointed by the performance of the conventional approaches here, things like caps on non-economic damages, pretrial screening panels, limiting attorneys' fees. These things just don't work in the way we hope and expect that they will. But I think what are promising are ideas that streamline the process of claiming, perhaps enabling people to get compensation without filing a malpractice lawsuit. Among those ideas are the so-called health courts. I've been involved in developing this proposal over the last several years. It's a proposal to create administrative processes for filing injury claims in the medical context, not dissimilar to how we compensate vaccine-related injuries or workplace injuries here in the U.S., or how many countries deal with medical injuries and accidents in other settings. Another idea is the so-called disclosure and offer programs that have been pioneered by places like the University of Michigan Health System, through which an institution takes responsibility for proactively disclosing when an unanticipated care outcome occurs, rapidly investigating the incident and making a full explanation to the patient where they find that the care deviates from reasonable or optimal care, they would make an appropriate offer of compensation without filing a lawsuit. And those programs, although we only have anecdotal evidence to go on at this point, have been very successful, not just in improving people's satisfaction with the process of injury response, but in bringing costs down.
Well, given those mechanisms that you would want to use, can you sort of frame an example of a malpractice situation that could be improved?
Sure. I mean, I think the most difficult cases are those that involve catastrophic injuries but unclear causation. We're not really sure what happened or the extent to which the medical care, as opposed to the patient's underlying illness or genetic predisposition, contributed to the bad outcome in the case. Those cases are the most costly in our system to deal with, as we currently do, because they require extensive investigation, which is done in through a combative process rather than a cooperative process. The institution would typically withhold information about what happened from the patient, who would be left to suspect that something had gone wrong, but would then have to hire an attorney to fight his way through tooth and nail to finding out what happened in the case. There would likely be stonewalling on the part of many institutions to try to keep the plaintiff from discovering that unreasonable care had occurred, and attempts to defend the claim even if the institution began to suspect that the care wasn't optimal. And the parties would likely spend, on average, 3 years in litigation, probably even more for a complex situation like that, before they reached a resolution. By the time that all was said and done, they would have spent about 55 cents on the dollar in terms of their total payment on that claim, just litigating the claim itself. It would be so much simpler if the institution would proactively conduct an investigation into very severe bad outcomes like that, communicate to the patient honestly when a deviation from the standard of care occurred, and make a reasonable offer of compensation up front. Similarly, if the investigation revealed that care was not suboptimal, it could also be helpful for the institution to discuss that with the patient. We have to understand one of the big reasons patients sue is to find out what happened. Why did this happen to me? What's the institution going to do to prevent things like this from happening again? Sometimes the answer is we didn't do anything wrong and we can't prevent this kind of thing from happening. And the institutions that run early settlement programs really believe that just being able to explain this to patients will diffuse a lot of the anger and prevent suits.
Well, let me ask you, you know, you talked about situations where patients really are injured, and that's something, especially in your article, that you talked about the importance of having a system like this. But let's look at the other side. There are nuisance suits that do occur, and there are physicians who have been advocated to, say, counter-sue if you are sued for a nuisance suit, say, let's thrown out of court. Is that something we should even contemplate, or does that just increase the $55.5 billion?
Well, I think there are a couple of different varieties of cases that might be called nuisance suits. One are cases that are over trivial injuries and that institutions will just pay off because it's not worth their while to litigate the claim. I think those suits are actually rarer than people tend to think. In a large study of closed claims that we did here at Harvard a few years back, looking at 1,452 claims from five liability insurers in different areas of the country, 85% of those claims involved severe injuries. It was very rare that a person was actually able to find an attorney interested in taking a low-value case. The second kind of claim that people tend to think about as nuisance claims are claims that don't involve actual negligence. There was a bad outcome, maybe even a serious bad outcome, but not because the physician deviated from reasonable care. The problem there is that it's often not apparent, certainly not to the patient, and perhaps not even to the doctor, what constitutes good care in a case. And when we maintain a system that doesn't provide patients with another outlet for learning about why bad things happen, litigation is the inevitable result. So I think those claims are worth concentrating on, but I think the way to get rid of them is not by trying to shut them down, for example, by making it harder to access attorneys or imposing higher evidentiary requirements at the time of filing, as some have suggested, but rather finding other ways to satisfy patients' primary need in the aftermath of an incident like this, which is to find out what happened and how is the institution going to help the patient get over the crisis that has resulted.
Let me ask you, you know, we're debating about how physicians and lawyers really think about this, but what about the average patient? What's the average patient supposed to think, and what are the consequences for them if this doesn't get fixed?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think one take-home message for patients is that we do all pay for medical liability costs to some extent. We know from the research that physicians and hospitals actually do absorb a large share of the costs. When their insurance premiums go up, they can't pass all of those costs along to the consumer. But we know there actually are some effects. So when their overhead costs go up a lot, physicians try to do more services. They try to make it up in volume, so to speak, and that affects the quality and availability of care that we all have as patients. But I think the other sort of thing to take home from all of this is that this is not a black and white issue. The study we did that came out with this number of 2.4%, some have called evidence that the liability system is out of control. Others have called evidence that this is really just making a modest contribution to our national health care problem. So it's a deeply layered issue that can't be easily reduced to sound bites. And that's the way our public policymakers have largely been treating this issue for the last few years, with opponents of tort reform steadfastly insisting that there's nothing wrong and proponents refusing to acknowledge that the liability system has some benefits and that costs may not be as egregious as some would characterize. So it's time to modulate our debate around these issues and start paying attention to the evidence.
Michelle Mello, thanks so much for joining us today on The Recovery Room.
Thank you.
Dr. Michelle Mello is a professor of law and public health at the Harvard School of Public Health. She's the lead author of a recent study about the cost of the nation's medical liability system. That's it for this week's show. More information about this or upcoming episodes of The Recovery Room, visit recoveryroomshow.org. Thanks to Sam Van Halgren, who produces the show, and to Recovery Room special advisors, Drs. Lance Stell and Christy Foley, of the Davidson College Medical Humanities Program. The Recovery Room intern is Sydney Rockwell. Thanks also to Patty Silverman, Anna WDAV, Linda Ray, Lisa Gray, Kim Klein, and General Manager Ben Rowe. I'm Dr. Rick Green. Thanks so much for listening.
The Recovery Room is made possible in part by a grant from the Society of American Gastrointestinal and Endoscopic Surgeons Educational and Research Foundation. The Recovery Room is a production of 89.9 WDAV, a service of Davidson College in Davidson, North Carolina. Find us on the web at recoveryroomshow.org.